listeners, it's time for another edition of the Sensitive Skin Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I'm the editor-in-chief of SensitiveSkinMagazine.com. And I'd like to wish you all a happy New Year's Eve Eve. That's today, but maybe it's not when you're listening to this. So if it's later, then happy New Year or happy 2037 or whatever. So our guest today is the painter and art critic Tom McGlynn. Tom's an old friend of mine. It's kind of funny. I met him in the mid-80s, and we had a good time talking about that, talking about our friends and mentors from back in the day, people like David Hammons and Steve Cannon, John Ferris, and all the other cool stuff that was going on in the East Village back then, all the great street art by people like Richard Hambledon, and Tom has a funny story about Richard, and Jean-Michel Basquiat, folks like that. It's funny, I actually lost touch with Tom for a long time. I'm not sure exactly why, but didn't see him for a long time. And then, well, strangely enough, in the early 90s, he gave me a copy of a book called Pure Mania by Stuart Holm and said, I think you're going to really like this book. And I did. I loved it. I thought it was great. And strangely enough, through completely different avenues, I ended up becoming friendly with Stuart Holm maybe about 8 years ago. And we were talking one time. I said, hey, do you have Tom McGlynn's number? And he gave me Tom's number, and I got in touch with him. And then I saw him couple of years ago when I was in New York. And he's a great guy. He's one of the smartest guys that I know. You know, I did my best to keep up with him. I think I did okay. But we also talked about his technique and acquiring an aesthetic and how he started out by playing with logos. Tom was actually in the very first issue ever of Sensitive Skin back when it was known as Poisson Siebla. He had the art in the first issue, his logo. He took the Lay's potato chip logo and turned it into something that said Good Lay. Pretty funny. You can actually grab a copy of that issue for free off our website if you're interested in checking it out. But we talked about how he did that for a while, and then he went into he started what he calls extracting the schema and abstraction, the phenomenology of the logos, how he derived a palette from an enculturated memory. Hey, this is his words, not mine. I'm not that smart. We talked about how pop culture ends up eating itself and how the street culture we were talking about ended up, of course, getting co-opted by the mainstream and how quickly that happened. Yeah, also talking about how some of the folks we knew at our local bar ended up becoming famous, people like Steve Buscemi and Mark Boone Jr., how it's funny to see them in movies and TV now. And they used to be our bartenders. At any rate, here is my conversation with Tom McGlynn. So how are you doing, man? Nice to see you.
I'm working in my studio. These are some of my new paintings.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see I'm very busy.
Wow. Do you have any shows coming up? Or
I have a show coming up in late April in Chelsea. And I have this residency, this fabulous residency for a year. It's called the Sharp Polentis Residency. And I've applied for like many, many years in a row, but this was the year I got it. 1,700 people applied, 17 people got it.
Wow, so, congrats, man.
Yeah, no, it's like, you know, the camel through the eye of the needle or whatever.
Uh-huh. So what exactly does it entail, the residency?
It entails a free 500, 600-foot studio overlooking the East River for a year.
All right. Nice. Yes.
Plus a nice community of artists, some of them who I know, some of them who I'm getting to know, but all very dedicated, you know.
All right. So you can take a break and chat with other people, see what other people are up to. And
yeah, I mean, for the most part, it's kind of like a haunted house. Like you kind of, you hear footsteps in the hall and slamming doors.
Uh-huh.
You know, everybody's kind of working. So, but we do have organized get-togethers once in a while, and people share their work. And you know, it's kind of like an out-of-state residency, but it's in the city. You know,
uh huh. And where is the show coming up that you're?
That's at Rick Wester Fine Arts in Chelsea.
Uh-huh. Okay. What are the dates again, so people can go see?
Well, I'm setting it with the gallerist, but it's probably going to be April 25th.
Okay.
Around there.
All right.
Yeah. Between the 25th and the 30th is the tentative opening date.
And this is a one-man show?
Yeah.
Awesome, dude. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, I had a one-person show there in 2017, which did pretty well. I wound up selling a few pieces, and they went to some good collections. One went to the Albert Knox in Flow, and another went to the Tang Museum at Skidmore.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So I have a good relationship with the gallerist.
So you know what I was realizing? I was like thinking, you're actually the first... No, you're not the first visual artist. I think the second visual artist I've interviewed. And I realized that, all right, this is going to sound ridiculous, but I've been a fan of, like, the painting, you know, for my whole life. You know, I when I used to travel a lot, the first thing I would do when I got to any city and settled down was I'd, like, go to the museum or museums and check out what they had and whatever. And it occurs to me that I actually know very little about the technical aspects of painting. You know, right. I'm still just like a complete dilettante. It's like, oh, I like that. And I, you know, couldn't necessarily tell you why. I might say, oh, I love the use of the light there or whatever. But, you know, if I look at you know.
It's a whole mixed bag, you know. I mean, it's not just technique. It's also a lot of it has to do with like an acquired aesthetic, you know, by themselves. The artist, you know, has to acquire their own aesthetic, you know, and you know, if they do that successfully, then you know they have a form that's unique, you know. So, you know, like I went to the Prado last March for a trip. And, you know, when you go through, like, for instance, early Goya, he's doing a lot of genre scenes. And you can tell that his palette was derived from more of a, like, academic training. And then he gets older and...
Never mind.
You know, the Napoleonic Wars overtake Spain, and he does those, you know, disasters of war and Capriccio Prince. His paintings get darker.
When was Goya? 1500s?
No, Goya was the late 18th and early 19th. Okay.
I'm thinking of Velasquez, maybe.
No, Velasquez is 1600s.
1600s, yeah. Okay.
But anyway, I mean, I don't want to make, you know, a roundabout way point. It's, I'm just saying, like, within his oeuvre, you know, there's his own aesthetic changed. And I don't know what was wrong with that.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I first met you, you were playing with brands was your thing.
Yeah.
And now you're obviously doing something very different.
Well, you know, to me, it isn't that different. I mean, to me, it's like a continuity because when I was doing the brands, I was interested in using like a ready-made template to make art, you know, rather than like a more academic template or an academic, you know, progress. I was more interested in pop art politically because it was class leveling, you know. And I was always interested in pop art for that reason. It was egalitarian and class leveling. So, but I also like language and I like the semiotics of like playing with like, you know, the semiotics of Dunkin' Donuts and U-Haul. And, you know, it basically wound up being like a cut-up technique.
Right.
I applied like a kind of a literary technique, not consciously, but like kind of just intuitively to cutting up Dunkin' Donuts, so it became OD, and like cutting off the hall of U-Haul, so it's just like this big kind of existential U. So I like the half-life, the semiotic half-life that all of the associations with those signs brought with it. But by reducing it in canvas, you know, you kind of extract the schema. You extract the schemata, which has more of a primitive hit for the viewer. I mean, it may have been the original market research that the designers of these logos put into it, you know. So by reverse engineering the logos, I was extracting the schemata or the schema, which, you know, in the history of abstraction, there's typically a progression from the observed object, and then it just, you know, the traditional way of thinking about abstraction is it gets reduced to like just the primary forms, right? But I was just reading something by E.H. Gombrich, who's a famous kind of old school art historian, and he was talking about how we actually carry around in our head schema that pre-exists the subject. So rather than thinking about
how, you know, so how do we pre-exist the subject, just from other things we've seen in our life, or are you talking about like archetypes?
Yeah,
or
I think his point was that that we kind of intuitively apply schema to anything, you know. So rather than think about looking at a observed subject and abstracting it or reducing it down to its elements, I like this idea that you're kind of front loaded with this schema, you know. So after working with the logos for many, many years, I realized that I started to get into like the edges of things and the colors of things, and so those, the phenomenology of the logos became more important. And so what I'm doing now, like this, the palette of that particular painting, for instance.
So our audience can't see, unlike me, but your painting is you're doing a lot of like, you're basically reducing these things to rectangles and, right, and squares of just solid colors, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
On colored fields. So what I'm doing is I'm deriving my palette from my memory. But it's a second nature. I'm deriving it from an enculturated memory, and reducing it, or just kind of exposing this schema of my enculturated memory. If that makes sense.
Sort of. So I mean, you're not actually literally deriving the color palettes of these works from the logos themselves. It's just like
not
sort
anymore.
Of a. What's that?
Not anymore.
Not anymore. Okay.
Because I've internalized it to extent, like I worked with those logo works for many, many years in the different iterations, different permutations. So it's like so inside of me, not just the initial stimulus, but also the processing of that stimulus. So I'm just kind of calling it up at will at this point, you know, and applying it more capriciously, you know, not denotatively, but connotatively.
Okay, but you are doing it very consciously rather than letting it bubble up from your unconscious, or is it a mixture of the two?
It's a mixture.
Interesting. So could you point at like any of these particular works and figure out like that it is derived from a particular logo or brand, or is it more of a mixture of schemas at this point?
Well, the schemas are reduced to rectangles.
Okay.
The schema is, you know, I'm interested in the idea of the generic, and you know, I wrote a long thing about the generic in art history and how it's kind of a recurring theme. Again, trying to reposition the whole argument or discussion about abstraction away from just reducing something and thinking about it as a way we just look at stuff, you know. Probably trying to align it with the way I look at stuff, you know. So like, you know, I can look around the studio and I can pick out a particular kind of mustard yellow that I associate like with a uniform from like a Dunkin' Donuts person. But the denotative meaning for that is lost. Like it doesn't matter anymore, you know? So in a way you could say they're realist because the palette is derived from an experience, you know, it's experiential in the sense of like Dewey. Art is experience, you know. But once they're put in the context of the painting, then they start to interact in kind of more multivalent ways.
And I am sad to say I haven't seen any of this newer work of yours in person because I'd like to, you know, see like what the brushwork looks like or the texture of the rectangles. I'm imagining it's not just like a flat surface, that there's some texture in there, or
there is, yeah. And I use a very long handle, you know, getting back to technique, I use a very long handle brush and I work horizontally, and it, the way I all the brush strokes in the same direction. And they're there, but they're very small, you know, and they just go from one end to the other. Like there's not a lot of articulation of brushstroke. So it's kind of like, I usually use the analogy of raking a Zen garden. So there is a phenomenology of the brushstroke, but it's meditative. It's more contemplative.
Very interesting. Yeah, no, yeah. I'd love to see this stuff. I'm gonna, next time I come to New York, I'll have to come to your studio or maybe to this show when it's up in April.
Another thing that's changed is I've moved away from working on canvas and I'm working on wood panels. And so the wood panels are much more physical. You know, they're much more physical. And I also like the idea, the quotidian idea of like a sign painter. So along with the idea of like the meditation, it's also just kind of like, you know, painting a door real perfectly. So I think for me, the technique is flat-footed in a way, you know, it's more Buster Keaton than it is like Charlie Chaplin.
I've never heard them used to describe a painting before. I like that though. And it's funny too, because I can watch a Buster Keaton movie and I still think it's fantastic. There's something about the physical nature of his comedy. And I watch Chaplin and it's somehow, it's dated. Maybe dated isn't the right word, but it's like, I know how powerful his work was at the time and like how it blew people's minds or whatever. And, you know, but I watch it now and it's just like, yeah, it's Charlie Chaplin doing his thing. And it's also just like we don't find him funny anymore, where people at the time thought he was hilarious, you know, whereas I still find Keaton very funny.
Yeah, because he was interacting with things. And you know, there's a great essay by the wonderful art historian named Barbara Novak. And it's actually about early or pre 19th century painting in America, and he talks about John Singleton Copley. He was a very academic, you know, when you look at his portraits of wealthy bourgeois in Boston in like 1760, they look like, you know, like very adept portraits of wealthy bourgeois in Boston in 1760. But there's something weird about them is that, and she makes the point that his objects in his paintings are more animated than the people. And she extrapolates that into an idea of American art where there's an objectness, an interaction with objects that kind of distinguishes a certain amount of American aesthetic. So I'm seriously making that, you know, analogy with Keaton, because his interaction with objects is very similar to like the history of American painting. To extend the analogy, Chaplin has kind of like a music hall theatricality.
Right. And because he was British too.
Well, yeah, I mean, he comes from the music hall, but the music hall comes from a histrionic tradition, right? Like an academic, you could call it an academic tradition. Mm-hmm. And Keaton's filmmaking doesn't. Like, Keaton's filmmaking comes from kind of just an interaction with the world, like a, mm-hmm. like a phenomenal interaction with, it's like experiential. It's almost like an analogy for pragmatism, you know? So I guess my point is that, you know, part of my aesthetic is about a physicality. That's why they're done on wood, and that's why the brushstroke is evident. It's just kind of very understated, mm-hmm. you know.
So what were your influences that got you going down this path?
Well, you know, when I was in school, I was really interested in pop art because of its mm-hmm. accessibility. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed, like, Ed Ruscha. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he incorporated semiotics into his paintings. You know, he uses words in his paintings. Mm-hmm. And I thought, cool and transgressive, and I like words too. So I thought. Uh-huh.
When was this, and where were you in school? So it's funny, I don't even know this about you. I don't know where you went to school.
I went to a small state college in New Jersey called Ramapo mm-hmm. College. But they had some great teachers there. You mm-hmm. know, I had an excellent art historian named Carol Duncan, who was, she wound up doing a study of museums that apparently was famous. But, like, you know, at the time when you're a student, you don't know really anything about, in undergrad especially, you don't necessarily know how important your teachers are, you know? Uh-huh. It's like only in retrospect I learned. Yeah. You know? But anyway, I got a good education in like the critique of postmodern, post-World War II painting, you know. And so Ed Ruscha, probably Ellsworth Kelly. Mm-hmm. The abstract expressionists were important just in terms of the phenomenology of like the action of painting and the presence of painting. Ed Reinhardt, mm-hmm. another important influence. Who else? But getting back to the pop thing, I think the pop thing was the most important because, like, when I went to undergrad, I didn't have the social background to understand any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My father was a milkman. He delivered milk to, like, homes, like, you know, very old-fashioned.
Yeah, in glass bottles, I remember. Yes. We had a little tin box. Yes. Nobody under, what, 40, 50 is going to have any idea what the fuck we're talking about. There's a little metal box that was like you sat outside your door and you'd get the milkman would come two, three times a week and drop off a glass bottle full of milk, take the empty glass bottle.
Right, which is, you know, I mean, in retrospect, it's almost like a 19th century, you know, it's like the old lamplighter.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. It seems like, doesn't seem like it happened 40 years ago, more like 100 or something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
So I didn't have the cultural background. So when I went to undergraduate school, I was like, you know, I saw a de Kooning drawing. I was like, wow, like, what's that? You know, like, I didn't really have any kind of framework. You know, I didn't grow up in a, I grew up in a literate family, but not necessarily anything to do with art. Mm-hmm. A lot of readers and teachers in mm-hmm. my family. So
So you found Warhol just immediately accessible. And
yeah, I mean, Warhol was difficult. I mean, there were some easier pop artists like James Rosenquist and maybe Tom Wesselman, right. Like people who were much more accessible.
Lichtenstein,
yeah. And I totally got it right away that they were using pop culture in a high art way, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it was a really strong influence. So when I got out on my own and discovering my own idiom, I went to that because I felt like what I really wanted to do with my work was to communicate, you know? Like the idea of the kind of the genius artist was never really interesting to me. Like mm-hmm. the idea of, The idea of situating the work in a realm of communication was what I was interested in, you know, in the non-art context, you know. And I remember, you know, hearing something like that Keith Haring said about admiring Walt Disney for that aspect, you know. He said Walt Disney was one of his, you know, his models. I mean, Walt Disney wasn't one of my models, but I understood why Keith Haring used that as a model because, you know, the movie Snow White, for instance, reached more people than like a gallery show that would be up for 1 month.
Sure, sure. And those original Disney movies were also just gorgeous too. I mean, they were painted cell by cell.
Right.
As opposed to the way animation is done now, but those first half dozen Disney movies, especially Snow White, you know, that was like a really bold move at the time to make a feature length animated film. Nobody had ever done that, so they gave it everything they had, and they put like whatever the best artists they could find and painted it cell by cell, frame by frame, every little
and
thing.
And now it's like a Fabergé egg.
Yeah. Yeah,
we look at that, you know, considering everything being digital, we look at that like a Fabergé egg. You know, we look at it like an incredibly well-crafted porcelain gift to the Tsar, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was a gift for the people, really. So like this, since I came from a working class background, I was not attracted to the kind of the idea of like the privileged genius, you know. It's never attractive to me. And maybe there was even something reactive in me about that, you know, like I didn't identify with the people who would even buy art, you know.
So you mentioned Haring, that was like back around the time we met in our running around golden age heyday.
Well, you know, Haring was like, I think I met you in 86.
Something like that, yeah.
86. And Haring, like, I think he got out of SVA in like 1979.
Uh-huh.
And one of the first shows that I saw that was really influential to me, you know, and relevant to this discussion of like accessible art was the Times Square show, which was an occupation of a massage parlor off of Times Square by people like Jean-Michel Basquiat,
right.
Kiki Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And a group of artists called Collab, and they were all about, you know, going down market with art.
Right.
And it was political, you know, it was political, positioning themselves outside of the established art world.
Right. Well, I remember how exciting it was. I moved to New York in 84, and it was really exciting to see, like, a Haring just, like, randomly on a black background where there was usually like an advertising poster just popped up in the subway one day or Basquiat what is his name? I can't remember. The guy who did the shadow, Richard Hamblin, Richard Hamblin. Yeah. Like seeing those around, you know, remember getting scared shitless a couple of times by turning a corner and there's like the shadow there and in the alley, and it was
I could tell you a funny story about Hamblin. I was working with my friend doing a silkscreen business. I was like doing short editions, and Hamblin approached us because he knew we were kind of like a small run place and to make a print. And so we were hanging out with him to make this print, and he told this story about in relation to Keith Haring. So Keith Haring used to make those chalk drawings on the black backgrounds of the moving posters, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that Hamblin did was, Hamblin, was he used to take like black rag paper and like stick it up in those areas.
It'd cover up the ads?
No. This is what he told us. And, you know, so he knew the stations that Haring was going to hit. So instead of Haring wasn't hitting just like those black empty ad things. He was hitting rag paper. So what Hamilton would do is after Haring hit the station is he would harvest forests. And then he would sell them, you know, to sustain his own art career.
Oh, that's hilarious. That's great.
Such a New York story, right?
Yeah. That's great.
everybody hustling.
Everybody hustling. And so you talked about how you like words in painting. Were you thinking of Basquiat when you...
Well, you know, Basquiat, he came later. I mean, I was already pretty into, a lot of word artists and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, like Ed Ruscha and Lawrence Wiener. I mean, at that point, I was fairly sophisticated, much more sophisticated than I was in undergrad.
Uh-huh.
It was mostly like an autodidact kind of education because I didn't go back to graduate school for like 10 years after I graduated. I graduated undergrad in 1980.
Okay.
And then I went back to graduate school in like 1994 or something.
Oh,
like
okay.
That. But, you know, the emphasis was on the street. The emphasis was on street knowledge.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It was all very exciting. And also like the amazing graffiti art that was all over the East Village at that point. It was really exciting.
Yes. And then the subsequent subsumption of that art into the gallery system was also an interesting lesson in like cultural subsumption and co-option, you know.
Didn't take them too long.
It didn't, no.
Yeah.
And then what was interesting was, you know, people like Tony Schifrazzi Gallery would show Keith Haring and Basquiat and their coterie of, like, you know, graffiti artists who were actually bombing trains in the South Bronx, you know, like the real graffiti artists.
Right.
But it was only really people like Basquiat and Haring who had the continuity. The people, most of the graffiti artists were kind of dropped after a while when they couldn't assimilate into the gallery system, you know. So all of that was very helpful, you know, for me just thinking about how, you know, the politics of the New York art world, you know, how it works.
Yeah.
The cyclical nature, the fashion and the cyclical nature of it. And, you know, back then you might have thought it was a paradigm shift that the galleries were adopting the graffiti artists. But like when you see the cycle, when you see them cycling out and like not able to assimilate.
Yeah. And also just the fact that there was so much street art, and then there were just like all the mini galleries that people were that popped up all over the East Village. It seemed like it went on for a long time, but I think it was just looking back, it was just a blip. But it seemed like there was like a little gallery on like two or three on every block in the East Village there for a minute.
Well, that's when I met you.
Yeah.
That's my first one-person show was around the block from Bazak's, you know, a couple blocks away, the 7B bar at a gallery called A&P Gallery on East 4th Street.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 1986. But, you know, I mean, I was in the East Village for a couple of years during that time. And, you know, it was great because people could buy, people could rent like a storefront for like $600, $500. And, you know, obviously, you know, the gentrification process started, you know, but there was this kind of sweet spot where people were able to kind of like actually sustain small galleries. And I don't think that's as possible anymore.
Probably not. I mean, even a couple of years before we got there, I mean, I knew people who'd rented storefronts for $60, $80 a month. Yeah. And people were starting nightclubs in their apartments. Stuff like that. It's kind of hard to believe looking at what New York is like now.
Like No Say No.
No Say No, yeah.
And there was you remember No Say No on Irvington?
Yeah. It was that was It's 6 o'clock, right? Was that No Say No? It was It's 6 o'clock. What time is it? 6 o'clock. What were those guys? You remember Fuck You and Gizmo? Yeah. There was that thing with the clock with the hands and yeah.
But it was a great place because they had performance series like all the time. Like, you know, every week they'd like these little performance series and I would check them out and it was great, you know.
It was great, yeah. And it was also just, it was so great. It was really, For a minute, there was just, you know, it was just totally lawless, you know. Do you remember there was a club on Avenue C around like 8th or 9th Street called Chandelier? Do you remember that place?
I do, but I never went to.
Yeah, but it was like, it was somebody's apartment.
Right, right.
And they literally just got they found a giant chandelier in the dump and hung it up. And, right. You know, they charge you $3 to come into their apartment. It was like, huh. This is just somebody's house.
Right, but that was what was wonderful about
it. Yeah, it was
right?
Fantastic.
Like,
yeah.
Like you walk into these situations, it's like this mise en scène is like actually the art. It's like the art on the wall often wasn't that interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But the social scene was much more interesting.
Oh, yeah. No, it was incredible. And just like there was, what was it, 8BC and the Limbo Lounge, those places. Yeah. And, you know. Save the Robots, yeah. But I mean, 8BC, if I remember, seeing like the Butthole Surfers there. They would actually get like touring bands to come and play there. But I believe they were powered by an extension cord running up to the streetlight outside.
Yeah, no, it was just interesting because there was a lot of freedom of movement, you know.
Yeah.
Like a lot of, not necessarily social mobility, but like a lot of lateral mobility. You know,
mm-hmm.
and that's because, you know, things weren't as expensive. And,
yeah.
You know, things were in motion. So, you know, that scene was kind of like, you know, kind of half expressionist, inspired by like the neo-expressionists, like Julian Schnabel, you know, like mm-hmm. a lot of the work that was being shown in the East Village was expressionist.
Mm-hmm.
But kind of like, you know, influenced by like German expressionism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like junky expressionism.
Yeah.
Know?
Well, the whole, it was kind of like Weimar Germany there, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
Berlin, Babylon.
Yeah, you really had to be there.
Yeah. I actually was, I don't know, this is probably about, must be 7 or 8 years ago. I was visiting New York and I was flying back from California and I was sitting next to this 27-year-old guy and from Sacramento, and he was telling me how he's been living in New York a couple of years. He says, oh, it's wild, it's like so exciting, it's so crazy. And I started like telling him stories about like what the East Village used to be like, and like when I was his age, you know, when I was, and he literally did not believe me.
Yeah,
you right. know. That he could imagine that the New York of like 2014 or whatever it was ever like just so open and wild, right? There's, and now it's all become, you know, sort of like the Upper East Side or something like that.
It's, yeah, well, you know, it's interesting when I see like these look backs and they're like gritty New York in the early 90s.
Yeah. Well, it still kind of was by the early 90s, but yeah, the 80s were something though, you know.
Well, you know what I'm saying? It's like there's these levels of romanticization of like when it was really gritty, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think between, you know, I got to the city in 1979, between 79 and like 84,
yeah.
It was truly gritty.
Yeah.
You know, because it was the flotsam and jetsam of like a beam. And the depression in New York, and you know, White House to New York, go fuck yourself.
Yeah,
you know?
yeah.
Like it was really bad.
It was really bad, and people were. I knew people who bought buildings in Soho, like 5-story loft buildings in Soho, for like $10,000.
Right.
Back then, it was
also,
like
Chelsea was just like, you know, it was like a wasteland over there.
Yeah, yeah, and the people who sold it to him were like, ha ha, sucker! You gave me $10,000 for that. White elephant, you have to pay property tax on that, you know. And
you know, one of the jobs I had to do, I did to support myself, like in the early 80s, was doing postering.
Mm-hmm.
And like I posted for like the kitchen and the poetry project. I was postering for like art venues, you know, Squat Theater. Remember them?
Oh yeah, yeah.
And what was interesting was, like, Chelsea was a great place because it was just all, like, vacant lots. And there was just, like, all, like, hoardings around all these vacant lots. So that was like the place where you can get rid of most of the posters because there was nothing else there. Mm-hmm. You know, even Sixth Avenue was kind of like, you know, a mess, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was interesting seeing the disappearance of that too, you know, like the street culture was kind of compromised by the fact that all of these places became actually worthwhile real estate.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's the whole, whatever you want to call it, timeline of gentrification. And I guess we were, you know, part of it. Right. But I mean, when we moved to the East Village, it was like, you couldn't really almost call it gentrification. It was just sort of, people were using unused property. There was just like, right. there were all the empty lots, buildings that had been torn down that people would like build little casitas in or start gardens. And then there was just, I don't know, like it was something like 75% or 80% of the buildings were just empty, boarded up, had been burned out, and yeah, people like would break down the boards and start a squat or whatever.
Which, you know, my wife, Tanish Weber, did on East 3rd Street across from Steve's place. And she started Bullet.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. And Bullet Space is still there, right?
Yeah. They wind up getting their building from the city. Right. So they're never like a squat / co-op. You know?
Right.
But that's where I met her and at Bullet. And Bullet, Andy Castrucci at Bullet was responsible for that book called Your House is Mine, mm-hmm. which was all about, you know, an explication of the gentrification process. And, you know, he included, you know, people like David Wojnarowicz and Lady Pink, who was like a graffiti artist, and people like me, who were young artists at the time. Mm-hmm. But he would do poster projects with the prints from the book, from that portfolio, that were at the crux of, like, the gentrification problem, you know, which when we were around culminated in the Tompkins Square Park riots.
Right,
you know?
Right. That's always been the demarcation line for me.
Right.
As things, I mean, it was starting to get gentrified and rents were getting more expensive already by the mid-80s, but it was before the Tompkins Square riots, which were like August 88, you know,
yes.
when Tompkins Square was like a giant homeless encampment.
Yeah, it was like Hooverville.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And which was also just kind of fascinating during the height of, you know, Reaganism.
Yes.
And mourning in America. And you had this giant homeless encampment in the middle of the East Village. And it was kind of a crazy time. And then they got everybody out and they re-sodded it and made it really nice and pretty and, you know.
Right, put some dog parks in there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
which before it's all just dirt.
Right.
There's not a blade of fucking grass in that park, I think.
There's still a lot of rats there, actually.
Yeah, well, that's New York. This.
Yeah, so, I mean, we both lived through that whole kind of, like, cycling through gentrification. I mean, you know, with regards to my work, I was still doing... I turned some of my paintings into T-shirts, actually, and I had a show on East 6th Street. Where is McSorley's? Is that East 7th?
McSorley's is East 7th,
East 7th, I had a show of T-shirts.
Mm-hmm.
I took some of my designs and I turned them into T-shirts, and then...
It's the most disgusting bar in the world, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like 150 years of urine and vomit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Soaked into the wood floors and the sawdust. Yeah.
But it's interesting because that was the time when, like, I started to think about moving away from using the logos. And because I saw pop culture kind of, you know, pop culture tends to eat itself,
yep.
like worm Ouroboros, you know.
Yep.
And I kind of saw the writing on the wall. I was like, you know, well, other people are kind of doing this to tournament of, like, logos, so I should move on, you know.
Right.
But before I did that, I turned them into T-shirts, and I had a show on East 7th Street. And it turns out, this is like another classic New York story. It turns out that the curator from the Cooper Hewitt Museum on 90th Street, Ellen Lupton, lived on that block. And she saw the show, and she was doing a show at the Cooper Hewitt called Mixing Messages, which was about street culture invading into fashion and art. So it was like kind of like right up my alley, you know. And so she put my t-shirts in that show.
Oh, cool.
Which was this amazing kind of situation because, you know, ostensibly the gallery was just like a little hole in the wall. But the coincidence of her walking past the window every day to work.
Right.
She picked up on the work and I was so but it's a great show to be in because it establishes a kind of datum where pop culture really started to eat itself, where street artists, I mean, you remember, you know, like the poet Miguel Pinheiro being cast in like Miami Vice.
Right, right.
I mean, people next to us in the bar, like Steve Buscemi,
right,
and Mark Bloom Jr., were all right. of a sudden like in the movies.
Right, right, right. right. I know, it was
and
weird.
The bar itself was in the movies,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, all this. I still get a kick every time I see Mark Boone in a TV show or movie. It's like, hey, there's Mark. And he gets like his beard and hair get bigger and bigger and bigger. And his belly does too, I guess, over. So, and I was like thinking, like, I remember I saw him in something the other day and I was trying to, I remembered what he looked like. He was skinny and had like no beard and like jet black, you know, like kind of a pompadour almost, you know, slicked back hair.
Yeah. And he and Steve Buscemi used to have a show called The Steve and Mark Show.
Right. Yeah. I remember that.
It was I think that Jim Jarmusch actually took a scene from, what was the one after Permanent Vacation?
Was it Stranger Than Paradise?
Stranger Than Paradise. See, yeah. There's a scene where we're all sitting around drinking tall boys.
Uh-huh.
And that was taken directly from this shtick that Steve Buscemi and Mark Boone did.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was lifted just right out of their act. Anyway, my point is that all of a sudden, like, pop culture was, like, accelerating. Like, pop culture was assimilation of street culture and assimilation of grassroots culture was accelerating. So that was a very important moment for me, too, like, in terms of my aesthetic education, my aesthetic political education, because I'm like, oh, this is interesting, you know? This is like, what's the point? You know, what's the point of, like, even making a differentiation between high and low art?
Right.
And when,
and you remind me of, like, and also, like, David Hammons was kind of interesting because he was always trying to be subsumed by the galleries, and he would always be like, ah, fuck you. I'm just going to go, like, make a tree in front of Cannon's house or whatever, you know?
No, I mean, I remember David Hammons making art on the tables in the booths in Bezos.
Right.
You know, he would just come in, like, with a little, like, thing and, like, make it on a table, you know?
It's funny, too, because that's also what was just so great about living in the East Village at that time. It was so exciting. It's probably still true to some extent, I suppose, or just New York in general. There were just so many people doing things that I'd known David. I think I knew David for at least 3 years and had spent hours talking to him and hanging around with him before I knew that he was a world famous artist.
Yes. Yeah.
You know? You know, I had no, I remember seeing, I think I was like in Paris and I got a copy of like Time magazine and they had a big piece of, I was like, what? wow. Yeah.
Well, you know, we both mutually knew, like, I feel fortunate to know, like, a whole generation of like black artists and poets, like John Farris, Steve Cannon, and you know, he was down there hanging out with those guys.
Yeah, and Pinheiro. I don't know if I'm Pinheiro. Lucky that I knew Miguel, but you know, we had some good times together.
No, but I guess my point is that, you know, that there were generations, there were like layers of generations of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I know, and John would tell stories about the East Village in the 60s,
right?
You know, and he would say, well, you know, this is all bullshit now because it's all gentrified.
Right. Exactly.
You should have been there, you know?
Yeah. I remember running into some guy and it's funny. It seemed like this is probably around that time in like the, you know, 86 or 87. And I ran into some guy who probably couldn't have been more than 40, but he was telling stories about hanging around with Hendrix in the West Village.
Right.
And about how cool the West Village was. And again, I like found it hard to believe that the West Village had ever been like a cool place to to hang out, you know. But he was probably talking about like the mid 60s when he was 18 or something like that, and it seemed like he might have been talking about ancient Sumeria for, you know, like the reality that had you know, the West Village at that point was all like falafel joints and you know, cheap jewelry stores and stuff like that.
But I'm glad you brought up David, because like I also learned from him, as from Steve and from John, you know, how to play with pop culture in a way that wasn't serious.
Right.
You know, or how to seriously play.
Yeah.
With pop culture.
Yeah, no, that's David. So David walks that line in a way that's fantastic. His like work is very playful. It's sometimes, you know, actually funny, but it's dead serious at the same time.
Right. So, you know, I mean, I learned from, you know, those guys about how to play, how aesthetics is a play. It's a play with aesthetics, you know. There's not a truth value necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? It's like doing the dozens or something. It's not.
Yeah, but there's at the same time, there's, if it's not necessarily truth, there's an honesty to the work that comes through, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I mean is that there didn't have to be a denotative connection between what you're saying and what you meant.
Yeah.
And that's what I learned from those guys, you know. Just basically, you know, it's kind of like the black tradition of signifying, you know. Super important. It's super important to my aesthetics now, you know, because what I'm presenting doesn't necessarily have to have a truth factor, and it doesn't necessarily have to have a denotative reasoning, which puts the emphasis on a connotative reasoning, you know. And that gets back to like the whole idea of like jettisoning the logo and just like using the connotative subconscious to kind of call up those things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, I would say those guys are also a huge influence on me. You know, especially maybe Ferris.
Yes.
But the fact that I don't know. I like the fact that when my writing is going well, it's working on at least a few different levels.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's what I'm talking about, like the multivalency of it.
Yeah, and the really interesting thing for me is when, like, I realize, like, I've got, like, you know, the surface meaning or whatever, and then I've got, you know, some kind of subtext, because, I mean, if your work doesn't have subtext, it's just, like, what, I don't know, mass entertainment or something like that. But, you know, what's really interesting is when somebody points out something that I didn't even realize I was doing, you know, like something happens subconsciously. I think that's when art gets really interesting.
Well, I have a good example of that, actually. I had a show last year at Seton Hall University in South Orange, and there was like this 18-year-old student who came up and looked at my painting, and they said, you know, this kind of reminds me of Miami Vice.
An 18-year-old knew about Miami Vice?
Well, I mean, I guess with, you know, like internet culture, you know.
Mm.
But it's exactly what you're saying. Like, there's no way. I didn't think of Miami Vice when I made the painting.
Right.
I wasn't thinking about Miami Vice. But
right.
His association with it is perfect. It's perfect to my aesthetic. It fits my aesthetic, not because it's denotatively connected to Miami Vice, but that it's the connotation is in our collective second nature.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's funny how... how influential that show was at the time. I remember we used to have Miami Vice parties. You know, people would come over Friday nights.
Like Game of Thrones, right? Like,
yeah.
But my point is that, you know, not the fact that somebody would derive like a specific, that specific an association, but what you were saying about your writing, that somebody might see the subtext that you might not see yourself, but when they say it, you recognize it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like, it's funny, like not one, but a couple of people who blurbed it or wrote reviews said, oh, this is a critique about my book that just came out, said, oh, this is a critique of late stage capitalism. And I was like, oh yeah, duh. Yeah, that's what it is. I knew I was doing all this other stuff beyond, you know, the surface of the story, which is like totally unimportant to me, you know, to the extent that I just got to a point in the book when I just said, eh, I'm just going to end it here. I'm just going to say this happened, that happened. And people, oh, what a twist. And I was like, nah, I just stopped it, you know, but yeah, it was so very obvious to me that like, that's what I was really doing.
Right. You know, and there's a cliche, you know, like about the badass like jazz musician who just has these cryptic things to say, but you know, like they floor you. You know,
uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like you know, the cat who's just sitting in the corner, and then like he just says like something, and you're like, whoa. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a cliche, but what's interesting is he's not looking for denotative reason. He's picking up like the signals in the air. He's picking up the vibe in the air. And he's picking out the schema, you know, and his clarification of the situation is what blows your mind.
Right, right.
It's not the fact that he's a genius. It's the fact that he's clear.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're not a Scientologist, are you?
What's that?
You're not a Scientologist, are you?
No.
No. Okay.
I didn't mean the sense of Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, because you say clear, you know. That's true. I mean, that's the job of the artist, isn't it? I mean, to
clarity,
right, or just to sort of explicate things that are really actually obvious, but that other people are blinded by somehow by their ubiquity. If that makes any sense, it's just very obvious that all this stuff is going on, and the artist just like makes a very sort of like. Deep. Oh yeah, boom. That's what's happening right there.
Right, but the communicative aspect, like getting back to my initial intent in becoming an artist, this is the communicative aspect.
Mm-hmm.
It's true that, you know, artists, it's a bit of a cliche, but you know, that artists can point out what everybody should know already.
Right.
But for me, like the interesting thing about my journey is like that the communicative aspect, the communicative intent of wanting to be an artist has always drawn me back to kind of like the symbol. And, you know, I'm using the word schema to kind of think about it differently than like dogma, you know, like a dogmatic symbol, mm-hmm. like a cross or, you know, whatever, star. And I think when artists, the cliche is that artists are like the antenna of culture and that, you know, civilians get it because all of a sudden they're, you know, it's clear to them what they should have known all along.
No, I'm but embarrassed by being so cliche.
No, it's not. I'm being defensive, you know, about my own romanticism. No, I guess my point is that if you're a technician, right, the other thing I learned from Farris and Steve, and to some extent from David Hammonds, is that your technique is like really important. You know, your technique is important. So artists, aestheticians, they're technicians, and like they're just more tuned into kind of like the schema of things.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I guess you could also say the same of, I don't know, of philosophers or mathematicians or musicians or whatever. They're maybe more attuned to the morphogenic fields or something. There's just something floating around, and it's just like they can grab it, and then everybody goes, oh, yeah, of course, obvious.
I'd probably leave philosophers out of that.
Okay, maybe.
Because they tend to be more wonderfully obfuscatory.
I was just going to use that word, obfuscationists. I was going to say, yeah, it's funny. My niece is in college, and she's like, really into like Derrida and, you know, Guattari and Deleuze. And I was like, oh, that's so, you know, like I gave her some of my old books. I gave her one of my it was the classic Jean Baudrillard book. And
right. And just simulation.
Like, oh, yeah, simulation. She's, oh my God, this is amazing. And I was like, yeah, you know, yeah, it's good to read when you're like, you know, in college or whatever.
Baudrillard in particular is brilliant about popular culture.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm not saying, I'm not dismissing philosophers, but I'm just saying I think that they're wonderfully obfuscatory. They're wonderfully digressive.
Well, it's funny though too. Speaking of Baudrillard, I remember again when I was living in Paris in like 1990, he had a weekly column in Libération, Libé, as they called it. Yeah, which is like the French version of the Village Voice. And reading him in French, my French was good enough, and my French wasn't great, but I could read him and I could understand. It was all very clear what he was saying,
right.
And it seemed like the people who would translate him purposefully made him more difficult to understand.
Possible.
Yeah. And there were neologisms that I remember. There was one that they always used to describe his work. And I was like, what the hell does that mean? You know, and his points were very, very clear and easy to understand reading in French as opposed to the, you know, hard to decipher sometimes English.
Well, he's probably more of the anthropologist, you know, like mm-hmm. he's
in. Yeah.
And, you know, some of the other philosophers are talking to the history of philosophy. So,
right.
But I just mean like when you're making an object of contemplation, whether it's like a painting or, a musical score or a novel, you know, they're all objects of contemplation. You're making manifest the theory. You know, mm-hmm. You're not theorizing. You're making manifest the theory, so mm-hmm. or the concept. Whereas, you know, if you're a philosopher, it's kind of you got to keep that thing going. Like, you know, making it manifest isn't necessarily the point. So I think there's the interesting thing about being an artist is there's a limit. You know, within your discipline, the wonderful thing mm-hmm. about painting is it's both a picture and a thing simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So because it's a picture and a thing simultaneously, I don't necessarily have to be just preoccupied with the visual. I have to think about the physical instantiation of it too,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of solves the mind-body problem.
Hmm. How so?
Well, most people don't think of paintings as other than pictures, right?
Mm-hmm.
But any kind of painting, whether it's oil or acrylic, I work in acrylic, the support is important, the presence is important, the limit of it, the unreproducibility of it is
mm-hmm.
important.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Luddite aspect to the artifact, right?
Mm-hmm.
That it's not theoretical.
Yeah, that's it. That's interesting, that the Luddite aspect of it, because... I mean, I suppose there's some people who have, yeah, I mean, I know there's people who've been, you know, using technology to manipulate art, but the act of painting is probably not a whole lot different than it was 500 years ago.
Well, I think it's interesting. I should speak for myself. In my own work, I'm interested in addressing like the present culture,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and in my work, the image is, it's kind of like in a floating space and it's asymmetric. Generally the symmetry within it is asymmetric and it's unstable and it's floating. And so maybe in that regard, it somewhat comes close to depicting like the unmoored aspect of the digital, you know, the skin of culture, rather than the whole body, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's anything representational in my work, it might be that. It might be that sometimes I work on the computer and I derive some of my imagery from Photoshop.
Right, right.
Like I process my imagery on Photoshop.
Oh, okay.
But I don't make a silkscreen of that and then, like, you know, print it. Like, right. A lot of changes happen between that and the painting. But there's a certain kind of half-life of the screen that I take along with it, you know, and a certain kind of luminism. There's kind of an unnatural luminism where the screen is lit from behind.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, so...
Right, as opposed to absorbing and reflecting light. It's projecting
exactly.
Light, yeah.
Right, so I'm not going to... It's important for me that I'm not interested in making paintings like a 19th century landscape painter, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Which would be the absorptive. That's a really good... That's a great way to say it, like the absorptive reflective.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I did a series of paintings called Decaps, you know, and I was looking for a title for the series that would create a parallel kind of semiotic prompt to inform the viewer that, like, you know, these are insubstantial images, like a decal,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
decal can be applied to any surface.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have any substance, you know. So I do think that I'm directly interacting with a sense of unmoored phenomenology in the digital age.
Mm-hmm. It's funny though. Do you remember there was a moment where it seemed like people were trying to do digital art and just like show them on computers and
yes.
Didn't quite work, you know, but I don't know. I think though that like writing has changed due to computers,
yes,
in a big way. And well, I mean, it's changed. It changed from. I'm not exactly how I would say it's changed, but it has very definitely changed from the days when people wrote in longhand,
right,
and then when people started using typewriters. And
right.
Then to the point where now people are using computers and we essentially have, you know, the endless scroll that that Kerouac
right.
Worked on by using the telegraph paper. Everybody's got an endless scroll.
Right.
Which and there's definitely been an effect on writing. I think part of it is that you see these, you know, more a prevalence of like 1,000-page books, which you didn't used to see so much.
Right. I mean, an 800-page book was like a giant book.
Right. Right. Now you see 1,400-page books. And of course, David Foster Wallace using the word processor, using his footnotes, you know, in his book that you never would have done with that. It's funny. I remember when he came out with that, what was it, Infinite Jest, the one that had all the footnotes. And I remember I was playing around with that idea, too. And I was like, oh, he's got a copy of Word 4, too. Cool. And the version of Word that made it really easy to do footnotes.
Right, right, right. Well, you know, that's all like McLuhan, Marcy McLuhan,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
The way things have changed in terms of the body's relationship to information, you know. He has a great quote in, I think, Gutenberg Galaxy, which is, no, it was written in 1962, but it's still awesomely, like, applicable,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's quoting, like, an African proverb. And it goes something like this. I'm probably paraphrasing it badly, but it's the eye is the instrument of the will, and the ear is the instrument of perception.
Hmm.
So his point in reiterating that was that the sonics of sound interact with our body, whereas the, you know, obviously the eye is part of the body, but
the
there's a
part
certain
of the brain.
Yeah, directly, but there's a distancing. Yeah. There's a distancing with the merely visual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it's shorn from the body, the merely visual, the you know, it's like you're that automatic pilot inside the head of the person who's just like directing it towards the visual. So
right.
I think that's where the culture is now. It's kind of like it's being led by the nose through the visual more than the oral.
Yeah.
You know.
And also we tend to, I don't know, maybe we do it auditorily too, but we tend to ignore most of the visual input that we get.
Well, that's because I think the organism can only assimilate so much.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a primitive, you know, the lizard brain is kind of saying, like, you know, stop.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's an aspect of the reductive quality of this. My figuration is very reductive in my paintings, and there's also the element for me that's important of saying stop. Like over-articulated imagery, because it's the culture is over-articulated.
Over-articulated. It's not even just, well, I guess the culture, just like the world in general, we're just like bombarded by visual stimuli.
Which I'm calling over-articulation.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a Baroque cathedral, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking more of like just society in general, as opposed to thinking of whatever almost pejorative word culture.
You know? Right.
Because when I hear that word culture, you know what I reach for.
Yeah.
Yeah. My gun. Yeah. You
know? No, but I mean, you know, it's getting back to the idea of the Luddite too. I think that there is, there can be a political reaction to the over-articulation of the imperative of assimilating all this stuff, right? It's not passive, it's like aggressive, you know? It's like, it's aggressively coming at you.
Yeah, no, it's true.
And one of my ideas initially in doing the detournement of the logos was cut that stuff up, represent it from the subject's point of view, not from the spectator's point of view, you know, not from the passive spectator's point of view, but from the active subject's point of view.
Mm.
You know? So what I'm doing now with my work is it's more esoteric in the sense that it doesn't have a identifiable logo, you know, but the intent is still that. The intent is still to kind of present a situation where the viewer themselves can create the interpretation. So for me, making like these images that are underdetermined allows for the viewer to come up with their own, or to access their own second nature, which means that they can kind of process to some extent their enculturation, which is empowering. You know, when you can process your own enculturation actively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very difficult to remove yourself from it and stand outside it for a second. Yeah,
it is. I mean, if you looked at my paintings, you wouldn't necessarily get all that, right?
Yeah.
But the point is not to be didactic about it either. The point is to be subtle. You know, the point is to be like that cat in the corner and just say, you're not talking about what you think you're talking about.
All right. All right, man. Well, you are the cool cat in the corner. So
have I made that clear?
You made it clear.
Clarity is important. You know?
Yeah. All right. Well, it's great talking to you.
Yeah, you too, buddy. Excellent.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.